Let's go, rock stars. I've opened up a small beta for the Mental Fitness Blueprint, a personalized 90-day guide for working with your mind instead of fighting against it. There's only 50 spots, so if you feel called to this work, I'd love to have you part of that first 50. Details are in the show notes or at mchampagne.com.
Java, who are you?
Good question. I wish people would ask this type of questions every single day from themselves.
Yeah, you know? Me too.
Right? I mean, Marco, just think about it this way. You know, I love your name so much. You know, as a Hungarian, when I moved from Hungary 3 decades ago to North America, the gift of living in a different country is that the names are always intriguing to me, right? Ooh. So when I see M-A-R-C, that's a very exotic way of writing Mark.
That's the French version.
Yeah, so it triggers in me that romantic aspect. So Marco Polo immediately pops into my mind. That's why I'm like, every time I look at you, I'm like, it's Marco Polo, as opposed to just...
I'll take it.
So yes, I wish people would ask stuff like this from themselves. Who are you? Because I don't think most people really think about this, that who are you? Not as an individual first, right? Because that's just a top layer, mm-hmm. but underneath. So if I want to honor our conversation, I want to go down in this rabbit hole a tiny bit. You know, that who are you, right? Who are we? Most people, when you ask this question, who are you? They start to tell you that I'm Csaba Lucas. You know, I live in Los Angeles. I was born in Hungary. You know, I'm a kinesthesiologist. I have a performance art degree. I have a business degree. All that jazz, right? And everyone is going to give you this stuff, which in my experience, Mark, it's the surface level understanding of who you are.
Yeah.
Because there's an etiology of us all, which is that we are human beings. And people are like, oh, okay, here is like the spiritual mumbo jumbo. And I'm like, not really. We know, every human being basically knows that we have this insane brain within our skulls. That brain is the most complex system that we are aware of in the universe. And that's it's in our skull. But most people don't really think about this, that it was already there before we developed the first freaking tool, basically. Most people don't really think about this.
Yeah.
Wish people would, because then they would realize, wait a second, I'm keep thinking that, okay, I'm a human being. I have this big brain because we have computers and all that. No. You need to ask yourself the question, what am I? So I have this big brain that evolved for a way of being that was there before any technology, before even really the first hammer, you know? I wish people would ask that question, because I think there is a lot there.
When did you, do you know, or maybe it was, you know, many moments, but one of the first moments in your life where you started to think about questions like, what am I or who am I?
Okay, so as you asking me this, there is a moment, series of moments that show up for me. When I was 6 or 7, we moved from a small Hungarian town to a bigger Hungarian town, a city, basically.
Sure.
And in this city, so in this first town where I lived, we had literally the last house beside a forest. Mm. And so I grew up the first 7 years of my life with no real limitation. We didn't have asphalt on our road. There were, you know, foxes, wild dogs, all kind of stuff roaming around. And I went into this forest regularly. I know my parents always tell the story that I was 2 years old when first time I got lost in the forest. But keep in mind, I wasn't really lost, because there were these girls who found me and they were asking, where do I live? And I led them home. So they,
oh, wow.
But I led them back to our house. So I wasn't really lost. Right.
Yeah.
But, so I grew up with no real limitations. My parents allowed me to roam free and just do whatever.
Were they freaked out when you... No, okay, it was just part of, interesting.
We woke up in the morning and my job was to get the heck out of the house and then go play. And I had a couple of kids who lived on my street, and I had a best friend, and we were kind of roaming around. We were catching lizards constantly, doing all kinds of stuff. And then I knew for lunchtime I had to go home. And then after lunch, I was outside again. And then for dinner, my dad whistled at night. And that meant I needed to come in for the evening. So that was my first 6-7 years. And then we moved into this bigger city. And we moved into an Eastern communist block, you know. And I remember I had my own room there. And I went to sleep at night. And I had a very strange experience frequently, which wasn't strange to me at the beginning when I experienced this, because it happened to me all the time. But looking back, at one point, I realized that was very strange, which basically, when I fell asleep, I felt like I was always got pulled up to the right top corner of my room.
Oh, wow.
And I was watching myself from that right top corner of my room, and I was there watching my existence. And so frequently that I thought that was the norm, that you just view yourself from the outside when you fall asleep and you are in this state and you're there. And then eventually I realized that there's no one talk about stuff like this.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, so maybe I shouldn't really think about this either. So for a while, I didn't think about it. And then eventually I stopped experiencing that frequently enough. And then my mom bought me a Buddha statue. Now, this might doesn't sound very interesting, but if you take in consideration that I grew up in a socialist country, you know, in Hungary, I grew up before the regime changing happened. That means the environment where I grew up, there were no private ventures, there are no taxes, there are no credit cards, debit cards, not really bank accounts either, right? So it was a very different environment. I remember the first day when we got our first landline. I remember when we got our first car, right? Yeah. I remember when suddenly we had a regular TV exposure, because we didn't have, like, you couldn't just turn on TV and you watch TV. And there was no TV.
Yeah. Gosh, gasp.
I remember the first time we got our first color TV as well. So I grew up in this much more analog world. So growing up in this socialist sort of setting, socialism, religion was a complete no-go, you know? So my grandfather was a very prominent person before the world wars in a certain part of Hungary. He's a mayor and all that. Okay. But he was very religious. But once socialism full-blown came in, you were not allowed to practice religion as a public official. And he was not willing to give up his religion, so they exiled him to a tiny village, you know?
Wow.
So, yeah, so it was really banned. The reason I'm telling you this, because getting a Buddha statue from my mom in an environment where religion itself was something that was not welcome, let alone something like Buddhism, it's an odd thing. And my mom, I asked my mom about this, why did you get me that Buddha statue later on in life? And she's like, I don't know, I just thought you would really like it. And I didn't know what it was. It was like a fat man sitting and smiling.
Yeah.
And no one else had this. My friends didn't have this. Every time when someone came over and they looked at, oh, what is that? Right? And so that Buddha statue was weird that it came into my life. And then for whatever reason, I was very much attracted to the ideas of meditation very early on. Now, again, meditation, prayer was not incentivized in socialist Hungary. My parents.
Can I pause you, Csaba, just because I'm hearing some notifications fire off. Maybe just go on to do not disturb.
Sure.
And I'll edit this. And we can just pick up from
there. I think we're good here. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Good? Yeah. Okay. So go ahead. Meditate. You're talking about meditation was coming into your life.
So I was interested about meditation and the way how this came into my world through actually pop culture exposure. If you think back in the early, like 84, 85-ish sort of timeline, Jean-Claude Van Damme came in pop culture. His movies actually came in to Eastern Europe as well. you know, before the regime changing. And he represented a different way. Now, he was a very attractive man, right? Strong, and as a young boy, you're looking at it, oh my God, right? And what was he doing? He was doing splits between two chairs and meditated. So I was like, yeah. What is he doing? This is weird. But because he was, you know, so charismatic, I'm like, okay, I guess if I want to be that strong of a man, I should practice that. So I started to practice meditation without any other tool, except I've seen it, someone does this. And then I decided, you know, I'm going to read little books about this somehow. So I told my parents about it. They got me this one book from Silva. I don't remember his first name.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know.
The Silva method.
That yeah. stuff, you know. So I decided, okay, I'm going to practice a meditation. And I started to practice it without any kind of guidance. And I landed with a system, which is basically, before going to bed, meaning I lay down in bed, and I was like, well, okay, so before going to bed, I'm going to meditate. I'm going to close my eyes, and I'm going to start to focus on a certain way of feeling. I wanted to trigger in myself a certain way of feeling that I wanted to enhance in my life. So that sense of ability, capability, biologically, physically, and the ability to seeing a lot of interesting, exotic things, the ability, you know, that vibrational state when everything is exciting and inspirational. So I was thinking about the jungles, the romantic aspect of Africa. I was thinking about the pop culture that oozed out of the United States and Hollywood and came into socialist Hungary. So I was thinking about all of these things. And I started to feel that overwhelming sensation of almost being there already, even though I was a 10, 11, 12-year-old kid behind the Eastern Bloc, you know, at night,
wow.
with my eyes closed, being so excited to connecting to this. Almost felt like I already had it, right?
Yeah. Were you still, did you reconnect to the zooming out at that point as well? Did that come back?
So
that body experience?
That's the thing, that it started to connect the two things.
Okay.
That I was in state, and then I moved up into the corner of the room, and then there was stuff happened, and it felt good.
Yeah.
You know, it gave me this sense of excitement right before I went to sleep. And then I went into a very, very much an exploratory stage once I went through puberty at the age of 13. I was a very athletic kid from early, early on. I remember age of 7, there was this swimming team that wanted to take me and train me to be an Olympic swimmer, which was weird. My parents were like, okay. And then at age of 8, 9, and 10, I became an obstacle course champion in my town as a little kid. I was very, very agile. And, you know, I did a lot of crazy sports. I got into canoeing to a very serious level. I ended up becoming the 3rd national championship in canoeing.
Oh, wow.
Hungary as in the youth division, which is a big thing because Hungary is the leading country in the world in canoeing. So it actually matters in, you know, yeah. in America, you say canoeing and everyone's like, okay, who gives a shit, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, Hungary is a very dominant country in this space. So I practiced a lot of sporting stuff, but really age of 13, when I was like, full-heartedly, I was like, okay, I want to explore physicality. So the meditation at night remained without any purpose. But there's another layer of meditation that showed up in my life, which came through pain and anguish. Because most people don't understand in North America what it meant to be in a socialist or socialist sporting system. I plugged into that when I was 8. My canoeing coach came to our elementary school and recruited potential athletes. And the way how they did that, by the way, this was the norm in socialist countries. A coach went to an elementary school and said, I'm a canoe coach. Canoeing is amazing. You have a boat. You are in the water. It's exciting. Indians, all that stuff, yeah. right? Just mention all these things that triggers young yeah. kids. I was like, okay, sign me up. I'll go. Went to his training session and it was cool. So then from age of 8, I had 13 training sessions every single week. Okay. That's the system. Once you plug into a sport in Eastern Europe, you have a lot of training. It's not like 3 training sessions a week. No, it's 13 training sessions a week. You know,
morning,
afternoon, every day. So I did that from age of 8 on. So by the time I was 13, 14, you know, I had a lot of abilities, but it didn't come free. It came through severe torture. For example, running was a very important component of any sports in socialism. They said that running is the base of every sport. This was always what I heard. By the way, my canoeing coach, who I'm still in touch with, became one of the world's most legendary canoeing coaches. He was 24 when he recruited me, and he was just starting his career, but he ended up becoming one of the most successful canoe coaches of all time. He still is the head of the, I think, the Hungarian Canoeing Federation, something, you know, so he's quite good. So, but the way it went with the running, we had sprinting type of running every single week. We had medium distance and long distance running. Like running a half a marathon was something that I did all the time, right? And that's okay. It's one thing. It's not a big deal as a kid. If you're very active, you can do these things. The problem was this. You didn't just run. They timed you every time. And if you ran worse than the time before, you had to rerun. Now, that's not a big deal when it comes to a 100-meter dash. No big deal. Or a one-mile run. But if it comes to a half a marathon, that's a pain in the butt to rerun. So, sure. And that's okay to do it once or twice. But do it for 8 years. And you understand how much tension that creates in your mind, how much you go through running that, oh my gosh, what if I run worse than last time? Then I have to rerun this thing. So you keep running fast. And that works because, oh, okay, I ran faster than the time before. But already in the back of your mind, oh, next week I'm going to have to do the same thing again. I need to run faster, right? So I had so much mental anguish that it was literally creating a panic in not just me, but many of the other athletes. So I was forced to figure out how to deal with this panic. The story, the pain was immense when you push yourself really hard and your lungs are burning, your muscles are burning, and that's not even your main sport. I did that part of my training. So the meaning was not there. The coach, who was a very important person to me, said, you got to run and you need to run faster than last time. And what you're dealt with is pain. I had pain throughout my whole system. And then I realized the pain was so harsh, I need to escape it while I was running. And the only escape was my breath. Hmm. I realized if I just focus on the incoming air, then it distracted my mind and I got into a rhythm that worked very well. So discovering, focusing on breathing while running ended up becoming my own escape, which now I know many, many years later, with a lot of education later, that it's actually one of the basic meditation techniques that you focus on breath. So I learned that through pain and anguish.
At a young age.
Accidentally.
Yeah.
Meditation, all of these things started to bubble into my life as a human being. And physicality was very prominent in my life. So all of that stuff got me rolling in life in this space of longevity, health, fitness, you know, all of these different things. On a very visceral level, I kind of came to this space early on. Yeah.
Did you feel like you were living at that age? I mean, so young though, but do you feel like you were almost living kind of two lives in a way? Because it seemed like you had a spiritual life that was developing really quickly. I want to say, you know, almost by default, I almost wonder how many kids experience like those kind of out of body or the, you know, when you're like pulled out of your body, kind of top of the core, like how many people actually experience that, but just don't have the language for it. Or of course the support around them that then later in life, hey, we can talk about this stuff. And I say that because I've been doing some work. I've been put in a beta program with the Monroe Institute. Have you heard of them at all? Yeah. And I mean, they've been studying this stuff for like 45 or 50 years. There's a bunch of science that's and studies and so forth. But most people just have no idea that this even exists. And, you know, what you're describing, I mean, I haven't had a parallel experience, but I've had experiences where I can't really explain them going through their process. And I just wonder, did you ever find anyone when at a young age to actually be able to talk about this stuff with?
No.
Yeah.
Because, and I'll tell you why. because I was surrounded with people who had to also deal. And everyone was developing their own thing. It was accepted of you to figure it out. Your job is to be in pain as a human, as an athlete. I was approaching things from an athletic point of view. Your job was to be in pain. That's the only way. Otherwise, you're not going to get better. So you need to figure out whatever you need to figure out here, right? So everyone was doing their own spiel. And whatever worked for me, everyone knew, it's not necessarily going to work for other people.
Sure.
It's a personal agency over your own being. And I feel like we don't allow that to happen in our world in many regards today. Now, as you know, I have 5 kids and I am a very involved father. My kids, my 2 older boys, already went through their childhood. You know, they are young adults in their 20s, early 20s, and they became extraordinary successful athletes. Now, it was mind-boggling to me how much the system here doesn't allow them to explore the very things that was the most important aspect of sports for me as an individual. Now, I managed to work behind the system.
I was going to say, for sure.
So, you know, and my first career, basically, I spent the first 10 professional years of my life as a coach who was working with athletic teams, individual athletes in many different fields. I helped them to bring the most out of themselves. I had the good fortune to work with the Lakers, with Borussia Dortmund players, to all kind of world champion athletes in figure skating, bodybuilding, softball, to all kind of different sports. So I do have, bless you, a certain skill as a kinesthesiologist. That was the first career, let's put it that way, that I had. Through kinesthesiology, I was able to help others to bring the most out of themselves physically. So when I came to my own kids, naturally, I wanted them to explore their biology the best way they can. But it was really funny to me how much the parents were in the way. Like if a coach wanted to torture the kids a little bit and punish them for something that they did by making them run around the lap, the next day the coach, all the parents were like, "Coach,
oh yeah,
do this to my kid. You can't punish them this way." And I was always like, "What are you doing? That's good for you. Kid. Why are you protecting your kid? You are in the way of your kid's exploration of the edges." Learn on the edges. Every hunter-gatherer knows this. Every person who has any level of freedom that they can provide for children, you realize that kids know what they're not supposed to do, yet they go there and they do that because that's how humans learn. You don't learn in comfort, in smooth, in easy. If there's a beehive, every person knows beehives is dangerous because there are bees in it. They can sting you. What do kids do if you give them free agency over themselves? They look for the biggest stick and they're going to bang that beehive, you know, because we are wired to learn on the edges. What in our Western world, what we do, we don't provide the freedom for, you know, these edges. So that's what I had the opportunity to do. And indeed, you had options because you were dealt with a lot of pain. Like growing up in socialism, and this is an interesting subject that I don't talk too much about. In America, especially right now, in this very strange political environment that we exist in, right? You mentioned socialism. Everyone is like going to be completely behind you. Let's say if you're a New Yorker these days, or completely against you if you are a Republican, right? Yeah. I think we need to dissect a little bit more what socialism is. There is the socialist way of governing, and then there is socialist ideologies. Socialist ideologies are not necessarily bad for you, you know? So in socialism, when I was on the street and I did something stupid, which I did because I had freedom, and if I did something that really didn't make sense, a stranger would come to me, smack me on the back of my head, and said, "Go home and tell your father what you did." Mm. And indeed, I was like, went home, told my dad what I did.
Yeah.
In socialism, where it was, at least where I grew up, this was a completely acceptable way of handling strangers' kids. Now, yeah. I know there is... What the heck? Sorry, my little camera had made this weird sound. I think the battery just died on it. So in a socialist setting, this was completely acceptable. Now, of course, everything is a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
This creates a potential problem as well in some regards. But if we embrace everything, then we realize that, well, you know, my parents were not alone raising me. They had my greater family and then even strangers in my community that it felt like they need to bring their best to the table and guide me. And that had the power to it. Now we are shielding kids so much that even a teacher can't tell them anything. Because
well, it's wild. We have a bunch of friends that are teachers, and it makes me think of like when you mentioned the edges. I mean, of course in athletics, but then just even reports or grades. I mean, like, and I'm generalizing here, but it seems like a lot of parents are like my child can do no wrong kind of thing, and just making so many excuses and so forth, and it's so solo that it seems like it's the opposite of, I imagine, what you experienced when you started to spend time in some of these tribes where, right, like to your point, it kind of takes a village to...
Well, yeah, so let's go about this from a little bit different angle. So
sure.
We talked about meditation and talked about children and children's upbringing in reflection of my upbringing. So as you know, I spent a lot of time with... very different cultures. And I'm going to give a little background.
Yeah, yeah. How did you get to that?
So I grew up in the socialist environment. And then I was a very good student. Besides sports, I was a very, very good student. So I was able to study in a university program simultaneously as I went to high school. So I did get my business degree very close after I finished high school.
Okay.
And I had this very athletic background, and I did very well. I was a BMX champion on the side as well in my city. I was in the county of that part of Hungary. I was a shot put, javelin, discus, and 800-meter running champion as well. This was not my main sports. I just did that on the side, you know, because canoeing was my main focus, right? So I was very, very physical, but I was a good student, and my family was very studious. My mom is a teacher. My grandfather was a very, very... highly regarded teacher. They were going to name a university after him. My whole family was very, very studious. So for me, being a good student was the prerequisite for me to explore everything I liked. My parents said, as long as you study well, you can do whatever you like in life. So I had to study well. Otherwise, I couldn't explore the sports. I couldn't explore other stuff. So that landed me with a very good school where I went to, and that allowed me to study in a university simultaneously. But I was also interested about something that was very not... Sports was foreign to my family. My family was not really sporty. It came from within, and they allowed me to explore it. And then arts was also something that was... My family was into arts, but not as a practitioners, but more like they appreciate it very much.
Sure.
But I was interested practicing it too. So when I was 8, I asked my mom if I could participate in this performing art class outside of school. And she knew the lady who was leading it, and she's like, yeah, sure, go. So I started to practice at the age of 8 and learn about performance art. But amongst my peers and in the environment where I existed, which was sports and very studious groups, arts was kind of looked on as a weird thing. Because if you didn't wear black and you didn't smoke, you were not considered an artist. And the athletes... And the studious group regarded this as a bad thing. So I did. I hated smoking. I hated wearing black. This is blue as well, by the way. I don't know if it's...
You're still working on that.
Yeah. So I hated black. So I felt like I was doing something that was illegal, practicing art. But I did. I was interested about poetry. I didn't think anyone knew it, that I was writing poetry on the side. I was exploring it quietly. But when I was 19 and I was going to college in Budapest already, my dad told me that, hey, I read in the local newspaper that there is this scholarship program that they're offering for people to explore. And supposedly with this, you can go to Canada because the scholarship, half of the scholarship program takes you to Canada and you need to teach children art and health related subjects, but you need to write an essay to apply. And I was like, Dad, come on. It's like the local newspaper on the corner of Hungary in a tiny town says this. Come on.
Yeah.
To explore it. But that weekend, all my friends went home from Budapest and I was alone in my apartment. And I'm like, what am I going to do here? So I caught the last bus that took me from Budapest to my hometown. I went home for the weekend, decided. And I was at home for the weekend and I was sitting around and my dad is like, here is the scholarship advertisement. So I read it. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to write an essay then. Why not? It's about arts and sports and I like both. So I wrote it and my dad sent it in. And then several weeks later, my dad's like, hey, you got a letter from the scholarship program. So I had them open. They're like, yeah, they invited you for a personal interview. I'm like, great, let's go for the personal interview. So I went to the personal interview and it went very well. And there was round two. And at round two, they said, hey, listen, we will want to call you back, but the next round is going to be in English. The problem is I didn't speak English. And it's relatively difficult to apply for a scholarship where you're supposed to teach in English, children, art, and health-related subjects. I didn't tell them I didn't speak English. I studied German and Russian as I was growing up. And I was pretty decent at those, languages, but not English. But my sister was an extraordinary student. And at the time, she already went to Oxford and she got her English teaching degree from Oxford. And she was one of the two best English teachers in Hungary at the time. So I told her, I have a situation. I have an interview in English in 2 weeks. So write out, please, 30 sentences to me that I can learn. Easy ones, don't complicate it. Easy ones that I can randomly toss out in any conversation. Yeah. So she's like, okay. So she wrote out 30 sentences. I learned all the 30.
What were the 30? Like, not what were the 30, but was there a reason behind those 30 to help with conversation? Or
I told her that I'm not going to be able to have a conversation, but I need to be able to use 30 sentences that I can randomly toss out and it should make sense. Okay. And she was kind enough to help me come up with it. I mean, it was very easy. She basically, here are 30 sentences. You can kind of use these anywhere.
Yeah.
One of the sentences was something like, and stuff like that.
That's hilarious. I love it.
If you say anything and you throw in and stuff like that, that automatically implies that you kind of know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
The reason I remember stuff like that, because I loved that sentence structure. And stuff. So I learned all this. So I go to the interview and there were seven people. And they said, okay, Csaba, you know that this is going to be in English now. And instead of answering in Hungarian, I blurted out 15 of these sentences back to back to back. So back to back to back. And they're like looking at me. And as I found out of the seven people, six didn't speak English. Only one of them did. And then immediately they said, okay, seems like English is not going to be a problem. So let's continue in Hungarian. I'm like, sounds good. So I got to win.
I'm out of my 30 anyway.
Yeah. So I got the scholarship and, and I basically had about a month and a half between finding out that I got the scholarship and then going to Canada. And I was like,
where did you go in Canada?
That's a good story because they gave me an option. This was back in the early 90s. Now, in the early 90s, there was no internet yet, no online stuff, right? So you had books. So I went to my local library in the small Hungarian town and I was like, okay, I need to figure this out, which one to choose, because I had the chance to go to Manitoba or British Columbia.
Yeah. Oh, this is a big one.
Now, it seems ridiculous now. But back then, I was like, well, it's Canada. I know that they live in igloos. That's pretty much all I knew about Canada. Let's read about these two places. I went to the local library, and the only book on Canada was from 1964. Okay.
Wow.
I read about, what is Manitoba? And basically, the way I summarize it, there are buffaloes and the open prairie. Ooh, so romantic. But there's British Columbia. There's the ocean. That's the only two things I was able to kind of boil it down to.
Interesting.
It's like, where should I go? I was very much into the pop culture version of America, which is cowboys and Indians, you know, which made Manitoba seem very, very attractive. But the ocean in Hungary is a landlocked country. The ocean was so romantic. I'm like, okay, let's go to the ocean. Looking back, I'm like, thank God I chose that. Right? So I went to Vancouver Island in British Columbia into a small town called Courtney. And that's where I did my scholarship. Hmm. So that's how everything started for me in North America. I don't even remember how we got to this.
Well,
but,
I was going to ask, like, how did the tribes and the hunter-gatherers come into play?
Okay, so I started my life in a socialist Hungary. Then as I basically got to the later phase of my teenage years, that's when the regime changing happened. And then I got this scholarship opportunity and I moved to capitalism. You know, essentially Canada and America are capitalism at its best. Let's put it that way, at least in the 90s, right? We could talk a lot about this, but whatever. So, and then I started to really learn about capitalism and how to exist, how people look at how to be human in capitalism. And I realized there were drastic differences in what we deemed what it means to be human in socialism versus capitalism. And I didn't look at it that one was good, the other one was bad. Because at that point, you know, Gorbachev that opened up with Reagan, all the things, that was buddy-buddying sort of idea between the East and West. The Eastern Europe opened up the gates. Western Europe welcomed and was willing to come in to help. Looking back, it wasn't so much of a help, more like an opportunity, right? But there was this loving relationship, at least the way I saw it, between East and West. So I wasn't judging, but I was like, there are drastic differences here. And both of them has good stuff in it. My dad, for example, who was in his 40s when the regime changing happened. So, and he succeeded in the socialist era well because he was an extraordinary engineer. He had three different engineering degrees and he really succeeded well. And then regime changing happened. And right when he started, was going to benefit from his experiences, the whole system changed, right? Mm-hmm. So he was forced to figure out this capitalistic way of being an entrepreneur. And he told me one day, late in the 90s, maybe early 2000s, that, you know, I was so glad that you guys were kids during socialism, because at 2 o'clock, everyone was done working. Go home from the factory. That was, you know, and he's like, afterwards, once you guys grew up and I need to figure out the capitalist way of succeeding as an entrepreneur, he's like, I was gone till 6-7 in the evening every day. So if you guys would have grown up in that time, I wouldn't have had a chance to be with you guys so much, you know, as kids, right?
Yeah.
And I love my parents. I had an incredible relationship with them. And still today I do have that. And I don't think I would have had that.
Yeah.
If it would
People
be
don't talk about this. Right? There's so many labels or preconceived notions of basically anything outside of how we're living present day and kind of in the West. And I love how you're providing a little bit more of a complete story. And I think you mentioned this earlier on, like, I think anything in extremes, we've got to watch, but I think the way that you're, at least what you're sharing on your upbringing and so forth, it seemed like you got a fairly balanced approach to that. And then of course, when you came here, you started to see, you know, the contrast and cause I'm curious, Chaba, but like, most people some people don't even ever ask questions like, you know, what does it mean to be human? And if they do, it's usually in their 30s or 40s kind of thing, or something, you know, you're up against a wall or something happens and you're forced into that kind of reflection. But you come over to British Columbia in Canada on a scholarship and somehow you're asking those questions. I mean, like, what was sparking that? And again, you know, is that what led to studying other cultures?
Yeah. So that was the trigger. And I remember looking at Dr. Kahneman's studies on happiness. So Daniel Kahneman, he's a Nobel Prize winning scientist who devoted his life to figure out what happiness is. Mm-hmm. And I remember early on coming across his studies, and it was relevant to me because he went to Eastern Europe before the regime changing and wanted to study happiness over there.
Oh, interesting.
In America, happiness is very straightforward. It's even in our constitution, the right to pursue happiness, right? So it's a very integral part of the American way of being, happiness, right?
Yeah.
Now, looking at his studies was interesting because he asked Eastern European housewives before the regime changing how happy they were. And 100% of them gave the same answer, which is, I never thought about it, right?
Oh, wow. Which, yeah.
Most Americans and Westerners, they dismiss that. They just don't know. But I understood viscerally what it was. Happiness was not a conversation piece while I was growing up. It's something no one gave a darn about, right? It didn't mean I didn't have a good life. I was just not focusing on happiness. Mm-hmm. But
did you feel people were happy?
Well, this is the interesting part.
Okay.
But here, once I developed, you know, my life in capitalism in North America, I realized happiness was a very important conversation piece. But that didn't make Americans happier than people in Hungary. So I was like, conversing about something, looking at something, this is weird. That there are happy people in America, there are happy people in Eastern Europe. In America, they talk about happiness. In Eastern Europe, they don't talk about happiness. And they started to make me think that that's so interesting. It was interesting to me. And I was like, I wonder how other people looking at how to be human. That's what triggered that.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, so still, Eastern Europe, it's still white Europeans. North America was unfortunately very white European way of patterning systems, bottom line, right? And I was like, I'm curious how drastically different cultures look at what it means to be human. And then I had the opportunity to do some explorations in South America, in Sub-Saharan Africa, and in many other parts of the world. And I was like, what if I deep dive into some of these tribes, these different way, different cultures. And if I spend extended amount of time there, maybe I can sample their way of looking at what it means to be human. So over time, I had the good fortune to live with tribes in Sub-Saharan Africa, sometimes a month at a time, for many decades on and off, not continuously. It's not like I moved there fully, but I went. I spent a month there, then I came back, and then I went back when I had a chance, spent 2 weeks there, came back, and doing this back and forth for several decades in Sub-Saharan Africa. I did the same thing with a tribe in the middle of the Amazon. I had the good fortune to examine a reindeer herder tribe up in Siberia, Chukchi reindeer herder tribe as well. I dug myself into a Native American way of looking at what it means to be human. The reason I'm putting it carefully, because if you're looking at a Comanche and you're looking at a Cherokee and looking at an Apache, it's three complete different way of looking at what it means to be human. So we white people and Westerners say Native Americans, but it's like as if you would say German and Italian, it's like completely different. But as a Native American, I had the exposure how different systems they developed. So I was exposed to an Apache, a Cherokee way of education as well. So I started to see that all of these different groups of people see things very, very differently. But over time, throughout the decades, I started to realize there were some overlapping similarities as well. There are certain things that they all deemed all used. Like, for example, if I do this, it doesn't matter where you go in the world. Everyone knows this means a threat.
It's a fist, for everyone listening.
That's interesting. So that must be very human, right? If all these independent cultures from each other, they all deem, they take this as the same sign, that means this must be very human. Mm-hmm. What's very human about this? And I started to think about this. What's very human about this? Well, I was like, it's a fist. What do you do with a fist? Well, you punch with a fist, right? You can punch with a fist. I'm like, okay, what is that very human about the punching? And I was like, okay, let's look at fist. itself. And I dug myself into it, and I realized the University of Utah actually studied fit. And I realized that it's actually a very human capability. Even though chimpanzees are like 98.6% the same as we are, they can't do this. They can only do this. Okay? They can't fully close their fist.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Right? They do a knuckle kind of thing. They can't close their fist. So this is very human. I'm like, okay, so if this is very human, there's only one reason to do this. You don't grab stuff like this, right? You grab stuff like this. So if you close it, there's only one thing, that this is a weapon. Dug myself deeper into it. So if this is a weapon, well, okay, punching, all right. So there are cultures where punching was dominant, kung fu, all that stuff, right? I'm like, okay, but let's look at other cultures. What is the fist's role? And I realized that there are cultures, the humans protect themselves like this against animals. Dug myself into weird stories. There was a very interesting story back in 1950s. There was a scientist from Holland that was exploring in the Congo, you know, African tribal cultures. And he had a bunch of tribal folks with him. And he was exploring. He was an anthropologist. And he was a really big man. He was 250-something pounds, a pretty robust human being. And a leopard attacked his expedition. And this man was very big, but he only had one arm, this anthropologist.
Okay, yikes.
So as the leopard attacked his small expedition, he attacked the leopard back, and he used his fist and fought the leopard, and he couldn't kill the leopard with his fist, but he ended up embracing the leopard in a way that when they threw a knife to him, he killed it. But he used predominantly his fist and his foot kicking to keep the leopard at bay at one point, and then ended up able to kill the leopard with a knife. Now, this is a story. And I'm like, okay, let's look into it further. So I went down in this rabbit hole about fist, and it made me connect to many interesting stories through many different cultures. But I realized that, yeah, this is a weapon, okay? So if it's a weapon, if it's very human, that means if you're a human being, you need to explore how to punch.
Again,
back to our earlier conversation, how much kids are able to explore fighting today? If you go to a normal school, you're not allowed. I grew up in socialism. Every single week, I was in a fist fight. Every single week, I was in a wrestling fight. You know, from about the first day of school, I will never forget this. First day I went to school, and there was a little boy who was pulling the hair of these girls in a break. And he was really rough with the girls. And it was irritating me. And I went to the teacher. I'm like, this kid is doing this. And the teacher just kind of ignored me or didn't come. And I was so frustrated that I went at the kid and I wrestled him down. And I remember how surprised I was because he was a very good wrestler. And this was my first day in school, in elementary school. And I remember clearly that as we were rolling around, I hit my head in the toilet bowl, you know, as rolling around. So it's a very visceral memory. And so we fought it. And I remember how hard it was to fight.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, I was like, I don't like this fighting thing, because it's really hard, right? The kid later on, unfortunately, ran down a really bad path and he ended up becoming a murderer, you know.
Oh, no.
Famous in Hungary, yeah. But so I went to elementary school with him and I fought with him. And then several times in the first couple of years, him and I, you know, headbutted. And that experience taught me to do whatever it takes, never get into a fight, because it's uncomfortable, it's not good. But if I never had the chance to explore that, I would have this idea about fighting that it's glamorous. Mm. Like now kids watch MMA, right? Most kids don't have a chance to explore, but they watch MMA. And they act tough. And they're mouthing off today to adults and everything. They don't understand what it means to really be in a fight because they don't have a chance. Mm-hmm. I remember middle school, when my older boys were in middle school, and this middle school had about 3,200 students in it, a big middle school, right? And we got a note one day from the school that their parents, there was an incident at the school, and we just wanted to send a notification to everyone. Two young girls got into a fight, and So we have a counselor on campus for the next 2 weeks. So if any of the kids have mental distress because of this, they're able to see the psychological counselor. We will have a parent meeting about this incident. So I was like, okay.
What is this all about? Yeah.
I went to the parent meeting and it was a big auditorium. There was a lot of parents. And then we heard about the outline of the incident. One girl pulled the hair of the other. The other one grabbed the hair and they pulled back and forth. And then the teacher came around and they pulled them apart. And I was waiting for where was the problem. And yeah, they said that. And they're like, does anyone have any questions? And I was like, yeah, I'm going to have a question. I put my hand up and all the parents were sitting there. Like, this was a big auditorium, a lot of parents. And I was like, is this a problem? Is this really a problem? Are we really sitting here? I took off time from my work because I thought there was something really bad happened here. Are we really talking about this? This is where we are at, where two girls pull each other's hair and we think this is bad for anyone. Am I off here? But I was in a fight almost every week growing up and I'm a very peaceful human being. You know, like, what are we talking about here? And they were like looking at me like, well, you know, anti-bullying and all that. And I'm like, well, I understand, but like, isn't that overstating the problem here? And we had a nice conversation and the school was, you know, okay about it, but the kids just don't have it. You know, they don't have a chance to explore. And I think a lot of negative stuff is happening because kids can't learn on the edges, you know? So again, circling back to the problem. So fighting is a very human thing. I realized it. So when I was used to coach athletes and I dealt with people as an advisor, I was like, well, you need to embrace who you are, which is you have a fist, you need to learn how to punch. It's important. So go take a kickboxing class. Go do a wrestling thing. It's very human. You must explore that aspect of your physicality. It's not about the sport. It's understanding who you are. And every single person who have ever gone to a boxing class, the first time, same story. Oh my God, this is so much fun. It's so interesting. Yeah, it's wired in us.
Yeah.
Back to your first question, Mark, which is, what are you? I'm like, these are the things that I think we all need to explore. What is really human in you and explore it? It's not about the sport. It's not about getting into boxing. It's about exploring an aspect of you that is very human. Fist is very human. This way of closing a fist is very human. Therefore, you need to explore it. Otherwise, you won't understand yourself what you are. You know? So this is what I meant by exploring. What are you as a human being? People need to ask more. What is this big-ass brain developed for if it was not around computers? It developed for a certain way of showing up in the three-dimensional world that most people don't think about. Now, I spent a lot of time looking at, okay, so what are we as human beings? As I was exposed to all of these different cultural tribal traditions. Mm-hmm. And I realized, well, every human being, if you live in the West, and let's say you listen to the radio, right? Let's go back to a little bit more analog version of it. How did you used to listen to radio, right? You turn it on and you listen and then you search for the right channel, right? You're searching for the right channel. You were tracking, where is the right channel? You start to listen to one. No, this is not the right one. You change the knob, went to another one. Oh, this is what I want to listen to, right? You track down the channel you were interested in. As a hunter-gatherer, what do? You go in the morning and you try to find a track that you can explore, which hopefully going to lead you to an animal that you can take over and you can hunt and you can eat. You're listening to things as a modern tracker of radio station in this regard. And you want to listen to stuff that enhances your ability as a human and it can lead you to show up better. So I was like, that's interesting. That's an overlap between very different, drastically different cultures. So I'm like, maybe this brain, because you're doing the tracking with the brain. So I'm like, and I was exposed to tracking and the Zuwasi, who are the most capable trackers. At least in the 90s, they were still the most capable trackers amongst all humans at the time.
And what made them be the most capable? Like, what did you learn?
Okay, so, and I really dug myself deep into what is the world's best trackers. And the reason I'm saying the best trackers, because the modern best trackers are the Navy SEALs. Navy SEALs are very good at tracking down patterns and systems for the sake of, you know, war. And they are the best trackers. And then when you look into it, who they deem to be the best trackers, and it's actually Zuwasi. The reason
I'm calling
it because they call themselves Zuwasi. Most Westerners know of them as the Bushmen.
Okay?
The Bushmen is just like if, you know, African-Americans prefer themselves being called African-American as opposed to what historically people used to call them when, you know, there were social imbalances. Now, the Zuwasi is the way how they call themselves. White folks call them the Bushmen. Right?
Okay.
The way how they prefer to be called. That's why I call them the Zuwasi. But they're basically, you know. So they were the best Western trackers, looked at them as they're the masters. So I figured, okay, let's go and learn from the masters. And I studied and I dug myself into what do they do? What is that so interesting? Because as far as I was concerned, I grew up in a country and my family is originally from Transylvania, which is today part of Romania. When my grandparents were born, it was still part of Hungary. And so we went there a lot. And that's a very wild part of Europe. The Carpathian Mountains is where bears are overflowing. And it's really a wild part. And my dad's uncle was a hunter. So me growing up, I was exposed to hunting, tracking down animals. So I had an idea what hunting was, which is like, there's a sign, there's another sign, find a bear, kill it, right? So I'm like, okay, so what is it so special what these people can do? So as I started digging myself into it, I started to realize tremendous amount how incredibly complex it is to track when all you really have is your physicality. So I realized that the Zuwasi was one of the only, at the time, there was a few different tribes around the world that practice the so-called persistence hunting. Persistence hunting is one of the most ancient way of hunting as a human, which is basically that you use your physicality and you're applying yourself and you start to track an animal and you are start exploring, pushing the animal with your sheer physicality and keep scaring the animal and keep the animal keep on moving fast enough that they can't really recover. So over time, you can literally make them have a heart attack. So you kill them with your sheer physical endurance. You keep running after them, scaring them. And that takes a while.
No kidding.
So I was like, okay, if that's one of the most ancient way of hunting without weapons, that must be a very human thing. So I went down on this path. Okay, I was like, how do you do persistence hunting? How do these people do who are still practicing it, not for show, but for livelihood, right? So I started to really dig myself into in the 90s and then had the good fortune to explore this. I had the good fortune several times to try to do this persistent hunting with them. Sometimes we failed. The first few times I went, we failed. Eventually, I was able to practice with them.
Where are they in the world?
They are basically somewhere around the border of Namibia and Botswana, more on the Botswana side, near the Kalahari Desert, right on the edge of the Kalahari Desert. And so I was there with them and I started to learn more and more and more about it. Now, I spent a lot of time on this, reading everything I could and then practicing and learning from them as well, being there. So I know more than most people about this, but my knowledge is minuscule comparison to what they know. So I'm going to give you the highlight.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, there is looking at tracks. That they look at the track, what they can read from a track is extraordinary. They can look at, for example, I'll give you an example. Look at two footprints. They can tell which footprint had more weight on, the left foot or the right foot. So if the left foot had, for example, more weight on it, that means the head was positioned towards the left more. So if the head is positioned to the left more, and there is water source to the left, most likely this animal is thirsty because it's scenting, smelling towards the direction of the water, right? So that's one minuscule idea. But the Kalahari Desert is an area where there's really nothing there. the first time going there is a little bit of a shock for your mind, because you have all these exotic notions of Africa, that it's abundant and jungle and nature everywhere. And you go to the Kalahari and everything is desolate, dry. You're like, there's nothing here. Why would any human ever spend time here, let alone hunting? And how do they stay alive, right? Mm-hmm. So desolate. Ground is sometimes has some sand on it, but most of them is pretty hard. Okay. So there are no visible way of seeing tracks most of the time, right? And I was like, so how do you do tracking here? It's very simple. There are some tracks that you see, some signs of the animal that you see, that individual animal that you ended up tracking. But you also know tremendous amount of your environment. You know tremendous amount about this animal and their habits. You understand the season what you're in. The day before, you paid attention how the wind was. You know, throughout your entire day, morning till evening, while you're awake, you're paying attention to the weather. Because the next day, when you go hunting and you see a track, you're looking at the edges of the track, and you know that the edges are blown off, but there's no wind right now. But yesterday in the evening, there was wind. That means this must have happened between the time between now and when there was a wind, and you knew when the wind was. So you constantly pay attention.
Yeah. I have to pause you because, I mean, two things just came together in my brain as you're saying this. I suspect that they're some of the best trackers in the world because of how harsh and how extreme the environment is, which to me, what kind of came into my mind, coming back to the kids again, essentially, we're trying to remove all of that and hope that they're the most wonderful people and most adapted and can thrive. And we're literally doing the opposite of probably what's required in a way. We don't have to go down that tangent. I just wanted to kind of put a pin on in that as you
sharing
this.
No, I completely agree. I mean, if you're looking at some of the most beautiful flowers, right? Lotus flower is beautiful.
Yeah.
But what's underneath the lotus? The more muddy the environment is, the more beautiful the flower is.
Yeah.
That works as a metaphor as well. You know, everything in existence works as just like the Fibonacci idea, right? As above, so below. One of the most ancient wisdoms that every culture shares, which is as above, so below, which basically means everything exists as a metaphor in existence. And that's what's so beautiful over our mind, that we are able to subtract metaphoric understanding of existence and the universe with this amazing device, because you need it to be able to translate sign as a tracker consistently. So as you were looking at the tracks and you were learning about this individual animal, beside that you really understood the species as well, you learned about this animal. Were they thirsty? Were they pregnant? Were they in pain? Were they young or old? Everything they were able to subtract from the footprints and the signs. And then when the signs disappeared, they had to become an artist. They started to behave like that animal. They took on the characteristics. And watching these people literally transforming into that animal, the movement, the sounds they make, they start to act like an actor, you know? Much apologies. My computer is unfortunately has to be connected to Wi-Fi, which connected to my text messages. That's why the sounds.
Mm. Can you just go up to the top right and turn your computer on to do not disturb? Let me just... there should be something like that.
There is no. Hold on. It doesn't give me anything like this.
Are you on a Mac or PC?
I'm a Mac. Yeah.
Yeah, there should be like a little toggle near the date, like two little toggle looking icons, maybe beside your Wi-Fi.
Sound?
Yeah, near the sound, but it's then.
Stage manager, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, display, music. I see the toggles. I have them, but.
Yeah, and when you tap on that, there should be something like, you know, like kind of top right, it would be a do not disturb or focus okay. mode. Yeah. So if you
just click,
there you go.
You just taught me something beautiful, Marco.
And you just put it in power and you'll be good.
I did that. Yeah.
Okay.
Great. So they needed to become an actor acting out based on everything they learned, you know, how that animal would behave in this given moment, given the environment that was going on while they were here, what would they do? You know?
Yeah.
And they turn, you know, so when you go through this mental exercise, what you start to realize that the origin of business is tracking. It's such a complex thing. Just as an entrepreneur, just as a business person, you go through different phases. Just as an artist, you go through different phases of your performance. You know, for a while, you gathering information as an artist, right? You learn your lines as an artist. You rehearse. And then once you get to a certain place, you throw it all away and you let it kind of go through you. And you trust that all the input all the exploration you've done is going to give you a good performance. You know, as you know, I with my performance art degree as well, I had the good fortune to go to Juilliard and really dig myself deep into the world of art. That's why I'm using performance art as an example. I was like, this is very artistic. This is what actually you do in business. And then obviously the ability to run after an animal for a pretty long period of time. I was like, physically, I was exhilarated by the idea that just like my canoe coach used to say that every human activity's base, sports base is running. I'm like, oh my gosh, these people are running after the animal.
Yeah.
And very different type of running, right? Because you don't know how long you're gonna have to run. So indeed, when I finished my canoeing training, I hated running with such a passion, Mark, that I cannot express it to you. I was like, if I never ran one more second in my life again, I'll be fine with that. This is where I was in my late teens. I hated it because it burnt me. I was psychologically destroyed because I was running in a non-human way. Indeed, Olympics, competitive sports are making you run in a way that is non-human. You know, running with a certain ideology of performance is not the human way of running. We are basically like, I'll give you two examples, right? If you're looking at a cheetah, you're looking at a wolf, okay? The cheetah runs for a very short period of time, really, really fast, right? A wolf runs for a very long period of time and exhausting the prey that they're chasing. If you make a wolf try to hunt like a cheetah, it's going to have a problem. If you try to a cheetah run for a long distance, eventually it's going to have all kind of joint problems, not designed to run long distances. So what I started to realize that, interesting. I hated the idea of running, but I was like, maybe I just look at running in a non-human way. So I was like, how do traditional folks looking at running, and I'm circling back, what's United Skull? Like, a Zuwasi runs for a long distance. Westerners run for long distances in competition. So we all run, but one of them does it for a living. The other one is doing it for, you know, some sort of ideology, which is being an athlete. I compete. I want to win. It's my identity, right?
Yeah.
So the run is commonality, but what is the human way of running? I explored quite far the Western way of running, and the Western way of running was exhausting and it was painful and I hated it. But I had many people who I liked who loved running. And I'm like, maybe I got it wrong. Maybe I need to examine it, what running's supposed to be for a human being. So I'm like, okay, so these people are the most masterful runners. Just like if you ever read the book, Born to Run, Born to Run explores the Tarahumara Indians in Mexico. They're extraordinary runners. In 1994, some of them entered Leadville 100. I don't know if you know the story. Leadville 100 is the most grueling North American ultra distance race. And these Tarahumara entered and they ran in sandals and their traditional outfits and they won them, right?
Wow.
But no Tarahumara trains for running. They live life in a particular way. Now, I had the good fortune to be exposed to people like Mark Allen. Mark Allen, if you don't know him, he was voted the best endurance athlete of all time by People's Magazine. He won the Hawaiian Ironman, I think, 7 times in a row, right? So Mark, you know, I had the good fortune to get to know him, and I know his story quite well. Now, Mark trained as those ultra-distance athletes, right? So I knew how much he needed to distort his life to develop those abilities. So he had a certain capability when it comes to running. And then there was this tribal culture, let's say the Tarahumara, since this is maybe better known than the Zuwasi, they had comparable, even slightly better endurance abilities. One of them distorted their lives completely. And socially, they were, you know, an athlete. I was exposed to athletes. Indeed, I quit working with athletes predominantly because I ended up trying to talk them out of competing, because I eventually realized competing has nothing to do with the human way of existing. And that's obviously, if an athlete hires you wanting to be better and all you spending your time is talking them out of, you know, competing.
Yeah, bad business model.
Now, I got to the top of my field by the end of the 90s, and the frustration of seeing that if I really want to show up for these athletes, I basically need to talk them out of competing. I'm like, this doesn't work. I need to use a different model, right? But with all being said and done here, I started to realize that the activity is the same, yet one is practicing a complete distortion how to be human, which is a Western Olympic athlete, versus this other individual who can run equally well, yet they actually didn't distort themselves at all. It was a lifestyle based of activity, right? Yeah. So I started to develop this understanding and this system that there is exercising and then there is lifestyle. Most Westerners look at running in a form of exercising. But if you really want to do it in a way how a human being meant to explore running, you cannot do it that way. Because if you get it with exercising, you're going to start to time yourself. There's a performance to it. There is no purpose behind it beside, okay, I should be in shape, so I'm going to run 3 times a week, 1 hour. So you do that. You find yourself just like 85% of anyone who practices running regularly with running-related injuries. Yet, the Zuwasi, the Tarahumara, they don't have running-related injuries, yet they have the abilities.
Yeah.
So how do I explore this? And persistence hunting was a very important learning for me to understand what is the human way of running. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to have to practice this. I need to master it. And I realized I didn't hate running. I hated the Western way of running.
Yeah.
And I started to explore it the human way. I wrote a book about this, which is called Barefoot Soul, Runner's Handbook. It's been a minute since I wrote it. You know, so I wrote that book because I'm like, I want this to be out there. What is the human way versus the way how pretty much everyone runs in the Western world, you know, which leads to injuries, all kind of problems. So I really pushed into it heavily, and I ended up running many, many ultra-distance marathons barefoot for 3 months every year for a decade, you know. Organized ones. I can't stand organized, competitive sort of way of thing because it distracts you from what running's supposed to be. You know, I ended up exploring running with my wife. We ran 6, 7, 8 hours, you know, and I realized what happens when you do that with loved ones. Just like the Zuwasi, they didn't run alone. It's not like you started to run after an animal alone. Not at all. You ran with a bunch of other hunting buddies. But if you ran down an animal, which usually takes somewhere around the shortest distance, if it's a very old male kudu with very heavy set of horns, it will take you about half a marathon, you know, in over 105 Fahrenheit degrees.
Yeah, exactly.
We evolved in a very a hot environment to be able to pursue animals at a relatively steady, high pace that the animal couldn't recover from, you know. Yeah. That's our specialty. Running a half a marathon in 108 plus, 105 plus degree, it is something else. In where there are no trails and stuff like this, running through the bush is quite different. So that's the shortest distance it takes. Usually within a marathon and a half, you will have killed the animal that way with your sheer physical endurance. So developing that ability, right? I was like, well, if I want to develop that ability, I need to practice it. So luckily I live in Southern California, high heat is usually not an issue to find something that's warmer. And my wife was kind enough to join in that exploration with me. So, and the running was one thing that we developed the ability, and obviously it's interesting. But what was much more interesting, how amazing it made our relationship, how much we talked through everything that usually you need some sort of therapy system to even those subjects. But my wife and I, because spending all this insane amount of time together for decades running together, we talked through everything when we were running. Mm-hmm. Indeed, these people constantly communicating about everything while they are doing this pursuit. So suddenly, running is a means to feed yourself. It's a means to connect to others. And then when I went down the science of it, and I don't want to tire you too much about it, but for example, we know chemically when you're sweating, a certain type of sweat releases oxytocin in your body, which is basically the bonding chemical, meaning the relationship chemical. Whenever you're around someone where oxytocin is released, you will be bonded together with them somehow in some really interesting chemical ways. So basically who you sweat together with, you bond together with. Mm. So it's very good for my wife and I, and very good for tribes. So there's so many intricate layers.
Yeah. It comes back to the basics is what kind of comes to mind as you're describing all of, and especially spending time, of course, with these various tribes and how they're living. And I mean, it's literally how we've evolved. And it's almost like we've forgotten this, but I don't even think we've known, or we haven't been brought up in a way to actually pause and remember it in some capacity or learn. So I guess, you know, as I'll start trying to bring the plane home in a way, but if you think of our health and longevity, which is, you know, obviously we're touching on that now, and that's a topic that is pretty prominent. I think, you know, a good one, given we want to live and not just live longer, but live healthy and share these beautiful moments with our loved ones and so forth. Like how have you taken all of these insights and learnings and perspectives, I guess, and been able to integrate them into, you know, air quote, kind of a modern day life that we're living in, but still harnessing, you know, the practices and the ways and the traditions and the rituals and so forth that have literally sustained full cultures since like the beginning of time? What can we do, like as listeners, like, you know, of course, you know, we can study, you know, barefoot running and so forth, but I guess what would be some of your counsel or guidance to people listening?
Okay, so as a hunter-gatherer, I go back to an earlier part of our conversation. When I started to spend a lot of time with them, I realized something very interesting. When you're out in nature, every time you take an inhalation, vital information is coming to you that your eyes potentially or your ears can't express to you. Like if you are, for example, in the Okavango Delta, which is very close to the Kalahari, so very close to where humans evolved, if you are there, you will always smell a musty elephant before you're going to hear it or see it. The reason I'm bringing musty elephant, because that's one of the most dangerous things you can come across. You can figure out how to distract a lion. I had the good fortune to explore how to walk lions off of their prey and how to overtake through your body language and control a lion. You know, this is what every human being, every hunter-gatherer mastered. You know, it was a very important thing indeed. We are pattern-recognized machines. Yeah. This brain, as a tracker, you're basically a master of recognizing patterns. As soon as you recognize a pattern, you can break it. So if you understand a pattern of a lion, you can break it. As soon as you can break a pattern, a behavior pattern of another creature, you can control them. Indeed, that was our mastery. This is partially what this brain developed for, right? Now, but it's much harder to break the pattern of an elephant than a lion because it's bigger. Yeah. A male elephant that is in a hormonal stage, you know, that is the hardest one to stop. So the smell of it will be able to kind of avoid the problem. So as I was experiencing and learning this, I realized that, oh my gosh, it's like I explored tantric meditation very in depth. It took me 5 years to transcribe all the 112 tantric meditation techniques. I put myself into it, it's a very robust system, you know. And I realized that the first one, which is called the Buddha meditation, because supposedly Buddha got enlightened with this particular meditation technique, which is basically you track in the inhalation as it comes into you and then let it go. I realized that I was practicing that as a survival mechanism when you're out in the wilderness with no weapons, that no modern weapons, because it's a survival mechanism. You need to understand what are the scents around you. Mm. And I realized I'm practicing the first tantric meditation that originated from, you know, Tibet, let's say, on that era, right? I learned about it in North America, and I'm practicing it in Africa.
And your mom instilled it in you when you were, what, 8 years old, when she bought you the Buddha?
Well, yeah, exactly. So there's this intertwining
circle.
But, you know, so the reason I am mentioning this to you, because as a hunter-gatherer, you have to take agency of your individual life. If you are not doing this, you will become lion food very fast. Mm. Now, once the agricultural revolution happened, what ended up happening, our lives drastically changed from hunter-gatherers, where there you had to have an agency over your individual existence because you were constantly exposed to very dangerous situations. You know, as an agricultural being, where you killed off all of the dangerous animals around your farm, where your life became very predictable, you knew what you're going to do every March, every April. You knew exactly how you're going to spend your days. You wake up in the morning, you grab your shovel, you're going to dig a hole, you're going to put a seed in the ground. You knew what you're going to do in September. Life became very predictable. A robot came into our lives, you know. You suddenly didn't have to have that agency over your own life because you became very robotic. You were not really in danger. If you didn't use your scent, your hearing properly and all that, it's not that big of a deal. If you were not a complete dimwit, you were able to exist. You were able to reproduce. You were able to stay alive, you know? Yeah. Industrial culture evolution came in. Industrial revolution came in. That kind of put the robot on steroids. Suddenly, you were not even in nature. You were in a factory. You were doing these very robotic things every day. You're doing this for literally a decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, a lifetime. You retired from this robotic way of existence. You know, if you were a dentist even, right? A dentist, at least you had to deal with a human and their pain. So you need to make some adjustments, but essentially you kept doing the same kind of job, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And then we come to our current moment. And that's how I'm answering your question in a very long-winded way. We came to this very special moment right now where technology, mostly to do with AI, but the algorithmic technology allows us first time to potentially, in a very near future, take the robot out of our lives. And then as you're taking the robot out of your life, here is the interesting thing. Again, the pressure is on as an individual. If we take the robot out of our lives, potentially, but we have a very comfortable way of living, it's very easy to be displacent as a human because nothing is really dangerous here, right? So looking at how you need to take care of yourself, it's never going to come from the government. It's not from any system outside of you. You need to take full-on agency of your existence because if you don't, you will be enslaved by technology. You will be enslaved by businesses. Right until now, Mark, I believe if you didn't get to know yourself the best you can, it was okay. What is the worst thing can happen? You will still know yourself better than anyone else. But that's not the case anymore because mm-hmm. there are is that can, based on your actions, they can understand your behavioral patterns better than yourself unless you really dig yourself into yourself. So you become the prey of businesses, you know? You become the prey of businesses that control AI algorithms. So if you don't take agency of yourself, if you don't get to know yourself better than ever, I mean, the age-old wisdom of know thyself is cross-cultural. Yeah. Everyone for thousands of years said, most important thing to explore in life is know thyself, to understand who you are. But if you didn't, boo fucking who? I'm sorry about this. Yeah. But, you know, it's like, what happened? No one had the chance to know you as well as you know yourself, really. But now it's different. If you don't take this seriously, it's not a luxury anymore. You need to get to know yourself. Otherwise, you will become a prey of modern technology. And there will be the split here. The split is the following. If you don't get to know yourself better, you don't explore yourself, and you fall into some sort of consumer way of showing up, i.e. you buy into ideologies and you're not exploring it for yourself, you will buy into longevity ideas, which poses as something that's good for you, but in reality, it's just another consumer system taking you down on a path where you can plug yourself into a system and feed the system itself, and it's not necessarily good for you. If you are not careful, AI will become your spouse. If you figure out what blows your hair back as an individual, as a social being, and you don't figure out how to deal with conflict between your spouse and you, between your worker and you, then you will end up wanting to deal with an AI who will be very good at pretending that they care, because AI is fantastic at that. And it will be always there for you. Always be supportive. Always blow smoke up your butt at the level where you need it, right? And at one point, you will realize, I'm falling in love with this AI, right? Yeah. And then when you're dealing with a human, that it's much more complicated. They're annoying. They don't always care about just you. They care about themselves too. It's a very different technique. You will opt to always deal with the AI. So you will be enslaved by the AI. But if you take the agency and you really get to know yourself and you understand yourself and dig deep, you can use technology and you can completely remove the robot out of your life. First time since we became an agricultural being, you can actually start to operate again as a hunter-gatherer, i.e. operate as an incredibly creative being. First time since we became, since we broke away from a hunter-gatherer way of being. And that's very exciting to me. It's very exciting to me that, you know, I am an entrepreneur. I have, you know, several dozens of companies in many different industries in 7 continents. So I am all about business and exploring life as a businessman. And using technology, a businessman with this, makes me so much more effective. It creates so much more joy in business because I can remove the robot that is really non-human. This repetitious way of doing something is not what a human being meant to do. I can remove the robot and I can really enjoy being a business entrepreneur beyond that was possible even 10 years ago or even 2 years ago. 2025, indeed, I think it's a really big separation as AI became so much more capable. So anyway, what I'm trying to tell you is that when it comes to longevity, you need to ask yourself the question, the wisdom I'm receiving, is it a type of wisdom that is going to try to enslave me? Or is it the type of wisdom that truly allows me to have a longer, higher quality life? And the problem is the following. Most things that truly creates high quality, long life, based on what we already know from statistical data, those things are inconvenient and no one can make money on them. And the problem is that no one is really going to put enough emphasis on those things because most people won't make money on them. The stuff that poses as longevity science today is something that costs a lot of money. Like my favorite pet peeve here is plasma removal, right? It's something that's very expensive. And I had this conversation with many scientists from very prominent places where, you know, who believe this is incredible. And I'm like, okay, I get it. Removing your plasma, cleaning it and putting it back. It's one way of cleaning stuff. I'm like, okay. And you say it creates longevity. I'm like, how many people live to 100 who had their plasma removed? Right. And they're like, well, it's new. I'm like, I get it. And I've been exposed to new cutting edge ideas, me, for at least 3 decades, you know, plus on a very high level. When I was working in the 90s with the Lakers and all these world champion athletes, I was on the cutting edge of longevity, health, fitness, performance already. Only find out 10 years later that many of those ideas, we didn't have the full picture. 10 years later, we understood more and we realized, for example, creatine. In the 90s, it was a thing that everyone went crazy on creatine, of all type of creatine. Mm-hmm. And then find out 10 years later, well, certain type of creatine might be not that good for you, you know? And then blah, 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 blah. So I tell them that, listen, I get it. I understand this is cutting edge. What we understand scientifically, it seems to be good. But what if we figure something out 10 years from now that we couldn't measure yet, that it was in the plasma, and we suddenly remove it? And I'm not saying it's going to happen. I hope it's not. But what if? Yeah. So you're basically just telling me that now there's a technology that if I pay $2,000 to $10,000, right, I'm able to get healthier for longevity. But it's just based on something that might be 10 years from now going to be questioned. But if you remove yourself from a big city and you go to a place where you can capture rainwater, right, for instance, and you're drinking that, then you're basically doing what most people who lived over 100 across many cultures did. If you make sure that you're part of a community where it is honest conversation day in and day out, right? Which we know from, even people can just look at the Blue Zone studies that became very popular the last couple of years. We know that there are consistencies between these Blue Zone areas where people live a long time. But the problem is if you tell someone who could afford to spend $10,000 on a plasma removal, hey, you pay $10,000 in about an hour, you will do something very good longevity-wise for yourself and you're going to live long. Are they going to do that, or are they going to change their lifestyle and say that, yeah, I got to move out of the center of Los Angeles. I need to get rid of my 5,000 square feet house. I live in a smaller house, spend significant time outside, not going to the gym, but develop a lifestyle where you're going to move throughout your whole day.
Walk everywhere. Yeah, yeah.
It's inconvenient and no one is making money on it. So no one is going to sell you that. So the agency over your own life as an individual is very important. You need to be able to tell what's going to suck you into a consumer process in the longevity world, or if you truly want to live long and high quality, are you able to make those sacrifices, start changing your lifestyle so you can lead in the modern world the type of life that people who live very long and high quality actually practice? It is possible, but it requires a systematic change.
Well, and it's back to, like, as you're saying that, I couldn't help but think about the running example again, right? I mean, you know, there's that example of running in this really hot environment. You're not worried about throwing on Nikes and things like you're literally, you know, this is a survival thing. But if you tell someone that, they're like, well, but I can, you know, or I can buy the Peloton, you know, treadmill and be, it's just, I think the two things happening are that, big themes coming out of this conversation for me, maybe I should say a question, it would be what would those tribes of the, well, they're still around, but what would they do? You know, like what's the basic version of this? Name whatever this is. And coupled with, I think so important what you're saying is spending the time to work on kind of that inner empire so that we also can, you know, use our intuition and know, because we know if we're quiet enough and we get hit with some of this stuff, like, I don't know, that just something about that seems off, right? Something about it, about being on some sort of long-term medication for decades and decades, name any disease, frankly, like something feels maybe off about that. Is there another way, right? But we've lost like that ability, or many of us have lost that ability to actually ask those questions, and because you get caught up in the autopilot, the speed of everything, right? And I think that's for everything. Like even with AI and the tools, like I know obviously you use this technology as well, but if you use it from the perspective of being human, I think that's the superpower moving forward.
I agree with you. I agree with you. Yeah, I think what matters, Mark, the most than ever, the willingness to explore and setting your expectations differently. People always overestimate what they can do in a short run and underestimate what they can accomplish in the long haul. So if you're willing to explore yourself systematically, little by little, and taking agency of your own life. And don't drink the Kool-Aid and recognize how much Kool-Aid is surrounding you. And what the Kool-Aid is really just enslaving people for a simply materialistic purpose. You know, do you realize how much you are enslaved through a system? Now, there's nothing wrong with materialism. As long as you realize what's going on, what you are indoctrinated with, what you are enslaved by. So if you're willing to explore this idea, and little by little, you looking at your life, for example, your personal social circumstances, your preferences when it comes to outfits, when it comes to technology, when it comes to the car, brands, your job, all of these things you need to explore to start to examine and take agency of your life and believe that you can figure this out with the help of the people who really care about you. It's not an individual journey. It's a communal journey, and you can figure it out. The problem is most people believe that other people have the answers, and if you just follow the people, you will get to an understanding. The follow me culture, the guru culture, is what really distorts a lot of the world of fitness, health, wellness, longevity space. Everyone is there. Hey, I know everything. Follow me. I have the answers. And people follow and they believe they have the answers as long as they listen. As opposed to, I tell people as much as possible to listen. You live 20 years. That means you have 20 years of earned experiences in you. Your job is to bring all the wisdom out of those earned experiences through conversations with the people who you care about, who love you and cares about you. And the amount of wisdom can bubble up in a conversation that you earned will serve you way better than anything that any of those gurus can tell you. If you go back and you're looking at one of my favorite sayings of Buddha is, if you meet Buddha, kill him, right? And Buddha, many, many ways, I mean, I thought about this a lot because it's such an odd thing.
Yeah.
But I think what Buddha was trying to say, if you believe I have the answers, you're looking at the wrong thing. The only answers you will ever come across that truly meaningful is coming from within you. So don't follow me. That's not the point. I got to this place with this. This is my personal journey. I got there. I want to show you it's possible. But don't try to follow what I did necessarily literally, because all you're going to do is follow me and you're going to miss the point, which is you. The wisdom resides in you. So this is hard when you live in a consumer world where essentially the whole system is all about making you into a consumer. And the consumer, the ideal consumer, operates by not believing that they can do anything. You know, as a hunter-gatherer, you understand that doesn't matter what happens. I can harvest nature anytime on my own because I know how it works. Now imagine how differently people would operate. If you would know, for the rest of my life, I will have a fridge that will be always filled with all the food. I will have a house that will always be mine. How differently people would operate. If they would know, I will never have to worry about food ever in my life again. I will never have to worry about shelter ever again. People would operate very differently, you know? And that's very human. We're not meant to worry about these things because you were meant to learn it early on, how to take care of yourself, being able to harvest nature, and how to take care of yourself as sheltering yourself from the environment enough that you can stay alive. That's very human. You learn that super fast. By age of 4, you kill your first animal as most hunter-gatherer, you know? You become a master of how to take care of yourself. You know, Western world, we are not. We made these consumers who depend on the system. Now, I'm not telling you to break away from the system, you know? You can exist in this Western world and utilize all this genius technology, this access that we have, you know? But you need to take agency. Otherwise, you will never be able to extract quality out of these opportunities. And that's what I'm challenging everyone to explore. How can you look at what we require to exist as a human? What are you as a human being? How can you practice that in the modern world and then utilize what the modern world has to offer And then you realize that first time in our existence, we can land with heaven on earth. You know, that many generations and thousands of years everyone talked about, but we can actually explore existence literally as if we lived in heaven. First time ever.
Chava, I can't think of a better way to conclude the conversation. I was going to ask you for some reflective prompts, but you just dropped those, and I'd love to just finish here. That was beautiful. Thank you.
Well, I mean, listen, it's the basis of our relationship and the basis of exploring this conversation, you know? And through our conversation, wisdom bubbles up that individually me or you alone couldn't have explored. But together through a conversation, we explored it. And if people listening to this, they know that I don't have any special answers, you don't have any special answers, you know, but together we can come up with something. And if they explore that with their wife, their husband, their friends, their coworkers, and willing to go deeper a little bit than the superficial thing, the wisdom that bubble up, that is what's going to create longevity for you more than removing your plasma. At least that's
well said.
And Mark, thank you so much for providing this space for this conversation. It means the world to me.